welcome to the Astropod. I'm Quinton Goddard.
And I'm Anna Quiter.
Well, Anna, welcome back. But I've got some bad news for you, I'm afraid.
What's that?
I'm leaving you!
Oh.
Yes, that's right. It's been a while now, and I'm beginning to finish my PhD, so I'll be moving on. This means for the next edition of the Astropod, there'll be someone entirely different sitting across the table from you, giving you fantastic banter.
Well, we're all really sad to see you go.
Well, Anna, it's going to be a shame to leave, but hopefully they'll find someone fantastic to fill my shoes. And for those Astropod listeners out there who are a little bit upset, don't worry, we've got some good news for you. It's March, and that means that it's the Cambridge Science Festival.
That's right, we're going to be having a booth like we did last year, where you can come and ask us questions.
So yes, this is on the Institute of Astronomy Open Day, which is happening on the 20th of March, right here at the IOA, and it's from 2:30 to 7 p.m.
Yeah, last year it was a really great success. We got lots of good questions, and we put together, as you recall, the special Astropod that had all of your questions and our answers.
We should point out that it's not just about the Astropod. There's obviously a lot more going on. There's talks and demos, games, displays, everything from the youngest kid up to, you know, the most inquisitive adult.
Yeah, I think that we tend to get thousands of people through the door, so it should be a real great astro party.
Yeah, please come along and speak to the Astropod and give us your questions, your thoughts, your ideas, and tell us how you'd like to improve the show or what you'd like to hear on the show.
Yep, look forward to seeing you. So recently there's been a sound artist here at the Institute of Astronomy. Have you seen him around?
I haven't, Anna, but I gather that you've spoken to him?
Yeah. So there's a guy named Matthew Applegate who's doing a project called Observations, where he's interviewing astronomers and collecting found astronomy-related sounds from around the Institute and putting them together into an audio composition.
This really does sound like a fantastically ambitious project, doesn't it, Anna?
Yeah, it does, but I think that it's really great that somebody is going around and recording all of these stories of astronomers.
So yeah, and he's actually going to be, well, I guess showing him, well, letting us listen to his recording at the Institute of Astronomy as well.
Yeah, that's happening on Friday, 12th of March, and Saturday, 13th of March at 7:30 p.m. here. So you should turn up early so you can definitely get a seat.
Yeah, I imagine this one's going to be pretty crowded, Anna.
Yeah, and one of the cool things actually about these recordings is that they're going to be archived in the Institute of Astronomy Library. So if you're interested in hearing sort of the background on how the astronomers that you hear on our podcast got into astronomy, you can come and listen to their recordings in the archive.
Yeah, it's a really good idea. And if you guys want to find out more about Matthew Applegate, I'll be speaking with him later on in the show, trying to find out, you know, what his reasons were for doing this piece.
Sounds good. Is there anything else happening this month?
An interesting question, Anna. As I rifle through my notes... There we go. Well, Anna, it may be snowing outside, but we are finally beginning to get a bit more light as we slowly head in towards spring. And this obviously means with, well, more daylight... It's the end of the observing season, so March is your last chance till October to get out here and use the telescopes on Wednesday evenings.
So, Quinton, do you know anyone with a birthday coming up?
I think I might. It's my father's birthday in a month's time.
Well, may I suggest that you purchase him a U.S. space shuttle?
That would be an awesome birthday gift.
So if you just have $28.8 million sitting around, American dollars, you could purchase for him a space shuttle.
That's a little bit out of my price range.
Well, you know, if that's out of your price range, you could get him one of the main shuttle engines for free.
He's a new sort of engineer, so he'd quite like that.
Well, then he would be capable of reassembling the engine, because that's the requirement if you want a free engine. You have to be able to put it back together and transport it.
Wow, I imagine that's a pretty big task. But, you know, are they just trying to sell these to make a bit of extra cash now that they've been decommissioned?
Yeah, now that they're decommissioned, they're just trying to spread the space shuttle around. So it's a little bit of global history.
Well, I think this would make a, you know, really good investment for some of the museums around the world. You know, actually having a piece of the space shuttle there would be a really good draw to try and draw in young people and get them interested in astronomy and space science.
I agree. And the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington has already claimed Discovery, but Atlantis and Endeavour are still up for grabs.
Interesting stuff, Anna. Well, that's enough of our jibber-jabber. Let's head over to Laura, who's got the astro news.
Hi, this is Laura with this month's Astro News. Youngest exoplanet yet. An international team of astronomers, led by Dr. John Barnes, have discovered the youngest exoplanet yet. BD plus 201790b is 35 million years old, about 100 times younger than the Earth, which is 4.5 billion years old. It's located about 83 light years away. Previously, the youngest known exoplanet was about 100 million years old. While this newfound planet is young, it is a whopper at six times the mass of Jupiter. It orbits a young, active star at a distance closer than Mercury orbits the Sun. Studying this planet will help our understanding of planetary evolution. ISS gets a panoramic new view. astronauts have successfully installed an extension to the International Space Station in a series of spacewalks. The so-called Tranquility Node includes a number of docking locations and will provide a breathtaking 360-degree view of Earth through its cupola. This marks the end of major construction at the ISS, an international effort that first began in 1998. As expected, the view through the window is absolutely spectacular, ISS Commander Jeff Williams said. When we have the others around it open, it will give us a view of the entire globe. Merging white dwarfs set off supernovae. Astronomers use a certain kind of supernova, called Type 1a, to measure the expansion of the universe. These giant explosions can be seen at large distances and follow a reliable pattern of brightness, so they can be used as standard candles to measure huge distances and hence find the rate of expansion of the universe. However, the exact nature of these supernovae was, until recently, still a bit of a mystery. New results from the Chandra X-ray Observatory suggest that the majority of this type of supernova occur due to the merger of two white dwarfs. It was a major embarrassment that we still didn't know the conditions and progenitor systems of some of the most spectacular explosions in the universe, said Murat Gilfanov of the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics, who published the results in a recent Nature paper. Most scientists agree a Type 1a supernova occurs when a white dwarf star, collapsed remnant of an elderly star, exceeds its weight limit, becomes unstable and explodes. The merger of two white dwarfs could be what pushes the white dwarf over the edge, or it could gain mass via accretion, a process in which the white dwarf pulls material from a sun-like companion star until it exceeds its weight limit. These two scenarios produce different amounts of X-rays. Chandra studied the X-ray emission from supernovae in five different galaxies and found that there was almost 50 times less emission than expected from the accretion scenario, effectively ruling it out. That's all for this month's Astro News.
Thanks, Laura, for the Astro News. So, Quincy, have you come across any interesting news stories this month?
Well, I have, Anna. I came across this fascinating story about a meteorite that crashed to Earth over 40 years ago. And they've recently done some new analysis on this meteorite.
Oh, what have they found?
Well, interestingly, when they first discovered the meteorite, which crashed into near an Australian town in 1969, they did some sort of rough samples and looked for a few molecules, but now they've done some in-depth analysis and looked for any kind of molecule. And interestingly enough, in the core of this meteorite, there's a whole host of organic molecules.
What are organic molecules?
Well, organic molecules are like, they're basically the building blocks of life, Anna. You know, there's sort of carbon rings and carbon molecules. All these things that eventually form amino acids and the things that make up your body.
So does this discovery then give weight to the idea that life made it to Earth on a meteorite?
Well, that's the idea. I mean, this meteorite is basically a sort of archaeologist's clue to, you know, how the solar system was when it first formed about 5 billion years ago. So this meteorite really formed in the sort of dust cloud that formed our solar system when our own Earth was forming. So it's kind of interesting to think that there were organic molecules, not life in this meteorite, but organic molecules in this meteorite when the Earth was forming. So yeah, it does lend weight to the idea that organic molecules might have come to the Earth from a meteorite or meteorites.
Well, I look forward to a reanalysis of lots of meteorites then.
Yes, exciting times ahead.
Because this month's interview is on the topic of music and astronomy, the history feature this month focuses on the historical connection between them. Music and astronomy have been united since ancient times. For the ancient Greeks, this is attributable to the mathematical nature of both musical and astronomical systems. Pythagoras, who lived from 570 BC to 495 BC, is credited with discovering that musical harmony can be represented using mathematical ratios. He then extended this notion to the structure of the cosmos and what came to be called the music of the spheres. In Plato's Timaeus dialogue from around 360 BC, he explains the creation of the cosmos by appealing to Pythagorean-like musical ratios for the location of the assorted cosmic spheres existing in his universe. Aristotle also expounds upon the music of the cosmos. In his work, On the Heavens, from around 350 BC, he explains that we cannot hear the music theorized by other thinkers to be coming from the motions of the celestial spheres because the nature of the heavenly bodies must be such that they are not producing any music through their motions. He then postulates that the absence of deafening celestial music means that stars and other heavenly bodies must be moving without any friction with their surroundings. Flashing forward to the modern era, inspiration and imagery derived from astronomy can be found in music. In some cases, astronomy is employed more for artistry than for the conveyance of factual information. Mozart's Symphony No. 41, which is nicknamed the Jupiter Symphony, Holst's orchestral suite entitled The Planets, and even Pink Floyd's iconic Dark Side of the Moon album all take inspiration and imagery from astronomy in the service of artistic expression. On the other hand, music can be used to transmit factual astronomical information. One clear example of this is the American folk song Follow the Drinking Gourd. It is believed that this song was used by slaves in the southern United States to orient themselves towards freedom in the northern United States while escaping along the secret Underground Railroad. A drinking gourd, another name for a large spoon used for drinking, looks like the Big Dipper, which is part of the circumpolar constellation Ursa Major. Since the Big Dipper is always in the northern sky, traveling in the direction of the Big Dipper will always lead to geographic north. To tell us more about music and astronomy, here's Quinton talking to Matthew Applegate.
Hello and welcome to the Astropod interview. Now, as Anna mentioned, this month I've got Matthew Applegate as my guest. Welcome to the show, Matthew.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Matthew, we've already mentioned earlier on in the show that later on in the month, on the 12th and 13th of March, we're going to be presenting at the IOA your composition entitled Observations. Now, normally on the show, when I interview people, it's normally scientists, so it's a bit unique to have a composer and musician on the show. But, you know, let's really start by talking about you. I mean, you're a musician, you've used computers in the past. Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm kind of more known as what's classed as a chiptune musician. I got known for reprogramming things like the Nintendo Game Boy and the DS to make them into musical instruments. I soon kind of grew out of what was called the kind of home market computers, the things that you could regularly access in your home. And essentially, I wanted to go to Bletchley Park and play on the big machines, the vintage computers. So I kind of approached them, and I did a large-scale musical piece there, a large project there, called Obsolete. And when I was there, I took recordings of also the volunteers, the people who were working on the machines, and got anecdotes, and I got the human side of the story. So after I'd finished Obsolete, I knew in the future I wanted to kind of include more of that. I want to include more of the human element to my work. So for this piece, I've actually, you know, was very fortunate enough to interview a lot of the researchers at the Institute of Astronomy and include that into the music itself.
So you mentioned earlier that you started off by using computers and reprogramming them to make sounds. How did you ever get into that? Were you a classically trained musician before that?
I was. I was classically trained in music, but the way into how I got into chiptune music was by accident, a very dangerous accident, I should point out. My baby sister actually came into my room. She was about 1.5 at the time, and she decided it would be fun to spill a bottle of milk into my Nintendo. And I was actually 12 at the time, and I must stress, this is very, very dangerous. I was 12 years old, and I had a screwdriver, so I thought I could fix the world. So I literally wedged it along the side and cracked the Nintendo open and broke off some of the metal components inside to gain access to the circuit board. And as I was in there, I was literally poking around inside of it, and I could freeze what was going on in the memory, and I could hold different notes. And this, along with the fact that my best friend's father was actually a professional hip-hop DJ, so he had a sampler, we could actually learn to sample different notes. So I would put in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cartridge, wait for the note I wanted, stick the screwdriver in, and sample the note I wanted out of it. And slowly over time, I learned to kind of adapt more of those sounds into my music. When the PCs came into the home, I learned how to emulate things like the Game Boy and the NES and so on, and eventually learned how to program them. And it's taken me about 12 years, a lot of time in my bedroom, programming, learning, studying all these things to kind of get where I am. But for the most part, you only hear about the last 3 years.
So really using sort of old electronic equipment as a musical instrument almost.
Yeah, I mean, composers have always, you know, mimicked what's in the environment. You know, Mozart, he went about, you know, copying the sounds of birds at the end of his garden. I don't have that. I have a crane at the end of my garden making lots of clanking and, you know, very heavy noises. My household is filled with electronic components, so I'm obviously going to use those to kind of inform my music. And it's, you know, it's very different music, but it is based on, you know, it is music, essentially.
Now, earlier on, you mentioned that you did a piece at Bletchley Park with the National Museum of Computing. where you sort of use the computers as well as speaking to people who worked at Bletchley Park. Tell us a little bit more about that piece. I mean, how did that come about in the first place?
I was, you know, obviously I'd gone through all the BBC Micros, the ZX Spectrums, all the things I could get a hold of, and it was actually at a point where I wanted to possibly purchase a PDP-8 or a PDP-11, which is quite a scientific, vintage, beautiful computer. I couldn't afford one because, you know, I was a struggling musician at the time, and I thought, where could I access one of these? So I looked around at the different museums, and TNMOC is probably, it's a fantastic museum, in all fairness. It is, you know, by far one of the best in the world. And they were the only ones that I knew of that had, you know, people could come in and access these things. So I wrote them a proposal. I said, you know, what I've done in the past, who I've worked with in the past, and what I want to do. And I put forward the proposal, waited a while, and eventually they were very keen on seeing the machines used in a very different light. And they were fantastic. They were very supportive. I was kept secret, though, for a little while. A lot of people were like, you know, what's he doing here? I was just showing up with my equipment, recording, you know, going into a room, recording all these funny noises, and then, you know, heading off at the end of the day. I was kept very secret for a short period of time, and then it kind of came out I was doing a musical piece there. And it was, an amusing story is that whilst I was composing it, I didn't demo any of it to the museum. They had no idea what the music was going to sound like. They just left me to my own devices, and I kind of thought, they must not want to hear it, they must not care about it. And on the opening night, I found out that they thought, we can't talk to him about it, he's an artist, just leave him alone. You know, he'll reveal it all. And so we were both kind of thinking, I really want them to hear it. And I, you know, but it was very funny. It's they enjoyed it, and we all had very, very good fun. Yeah.
So we've talked a lot about using the sounds, but I mean, how do you go about, once you've got a collection of sounds from old computers and interviews, how do you turn that into an actual composition? What ideas do you sort of try to use to fuse all that together?
Well, for this piece, observations, the rhythms, some of them are taken from the speech patterns of the people I've interviewed. So I'll take a sentence of somebody talking, and I'll notate the kind of intonations on them. But then I won't use their voice in the actual music. I'll use a sound of a telescope opening or the dome actually moving around in place of those notes. So I'll create the rhythms are actually created by the speech patterns. So it's all informed by the people and the machines here at the Institute. It's there is actually some talking from the interviews in the pieces as well, but there's multiple layers of the people and the machines in the music itself. So.
Now, obviously, we're going to show the whole pieces here at the Institute of Astronomy on the 12th and 13th, but we thought it might be nice to give the sort of listeners of the Astropod a quick preview now. So we'll just show you, let you listen to some few clips, and then we'll come back and speak a bit more with Matthew. Thank you very much for letting us listen to those pieces in advance, Matthew. Now, this is obviously quite different from the work you did at Bletchley Park, which, you know, follows on fairly closely to your love and fascination with computers. How did you get involved with the Institute of Astronomy and the observations?
It was, might sound a bit arrogant, but I wanted a challenge. I wanted to go somewhere where it's not particularly known for sound. And so I thought, well, there isn't any sound in space, is there? So instead of actually going to space, I thought I would talk to people here on Earth and observe the people, the interactions between the different researchers as a whole. It's the piece itself isn't about just one type of astronomy. It's not about observing, you know, observational astronomy. It's about me as an individual observing the people here. And when I do the interviews, I have 5 set questions, and those questions cover very different areas of their studies and their life. And there's a question in there about what do you know now as an adult researcher that you didn't know as a child fascinated by astronomy. And for a lot of them, it's been a slow kind of trickle of information that built up a much larger picture. And that question over time has become more valid for me, because I was coming here and having daily epiphanies of how these different things were going on in the universe, and I had no idea. So, and there's also other questions about, you know, what got them into astronomy. So it allows me to observe them observing themselves. So there's multiple layers of kind of looking back on their past. And there's also a question about, you know, what excites them about research. And it's really amazing to see them literally light up with enthusiasm about what they're covering. It's a really, really nice thing to see.
I mean, astronomy has obviously traditionally been a very visual science, with the HST. That's probably been the best sort of example of you know, getting the public involved and interested in astronomy because of the beautiful pictures it's produced. And now you've produced a sort of audio sort of example of astronomy. Are you hoping that this is going to get the public interest in astronomy as well? Give them another viewpoint into the kind of work that happens at the Institute of Astronomy?
Very much so. I approach kind of astronomy in a kind of childlike manner. You know, it's always occupied the kind of wonder element in my mind. I always look upon astronomy as, you know, something wonderful. And even now that I've learnt more about the factual side of it, if you like, I still, you know, think how, you know, even more so how wonderful it is. So I hope it'll engage more people. It's a new way into astronomy, certainly, than, if you like, more traditional methods of actually looking through a telescope. But yeah, I'm hoping it will engage people on very, very different levels.
Now, we normally talk about people interested in astronomy. Do you also hope this is going to get youngsters interested in, you know, the uses of music outside just, you know, being entertained by it?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually helped a lot of my musical students kind of understand what you can do with sound, what you can do with music. It doesn't have to be a pop song. It doesn't have to be, you know, what's classed as traditional music. You can go off and explore whatever you like in that area. So it's been already, you know, showing some examples to my students has been very helpful to them to get into that side of things, because they largely came into it to kind of pick up a guitar, write a song, but this is very different to that.
Yeah, it's certainly a new way of using music, and certainly fascinating. Now, in your sort of travels around the Institute of Astronomy, you've spoken to so many people here. What's the sort of one most impressive thing, one most useful thing that you would take away from all those interviews?
How happy the people are. I've interviewed so many, you know, very, very cheerful, very, very happy people. And, you know, it kind of dawned on me, how, you know, how's this happening? And I kind of thought, well, they're studying something that they're passionate about. And it's been a really positive, good vibe. And I think that for me, that on a kind of emotional level, on a kind of technical level, I suppose it's talking about black holes, that you can't actually see them, and have somebody explain it to me in terms I can understand, it was like a really kind of light bulb moment for me. I was able to go home on the train and sit there for about an hour and a half thinking about it, and how fascinating it is, the work that's going on here. So yeah, there's been quite a few.
Well, Matthew, on behalf of all of us here at the Institute of Astronomy, you know, thanks very much for coming on the show, and thank you very much for, you know, actually taking the time to sort of try and fuse what you love with the kind of work that we love as well. And you know, I really think the project's going to be fantastic, and I hope that everyone else comes along to the Institute of Astronomy and listens in on the 12th and 13th of March.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks, Quincy and Matt. So, hey, Quincy, have you heard about the Spirit rover on Mars?
I hear that it's having some issues.
Yeah, you know, over the course of the past few astropods, we've been tracking its slow demise. But now, the poor little guy is stuck.
It has all been a bit depressing over the last few months. Is there any good news, Anna?
Nope, they're just going to stop trying to move him. So they're hoping that he will last the Martian winter, but it's not looking too great.
That gets pretty chilly, doesn't it?
It does. But if he does survive, then they can use the Spirit Rover as a stationary science station. And so he can still take pictures and still record the weather and that sort of stuff. So he'll still be providing useful scientific information, but he just won't be able to move around anymore.
I see. Are they going to rename the Spirit Rover just as sort of the Spirit Base or the Spirit Lab? Or I'm not sure.
No, I haven't heard anything about that. So I guess that he'll just become, you know, the Spirit former rover.
Well, it's a sad end, but at least he's still going to be useful, and hopefully, if he survives the winter, still doing some useful science for
us. Well, you know, these guys, they already outlasted their projected usefulness. You know, they've been going for several years now, and they were only expected to last a few months.
And they were certainly more use than that Beagle 2 lander was. Well, guys, just in case we do actually get a clear night and you want to go out observing, here's Alex to give you some information about the sky at night.
Up in the skies this month, spring is on its way, with March the 20th marking the official start of spring. As a consequence, over the course of this month, the Big Dipper will be rising higher into the northeastern sky, whilst the W-shaped Cassiopeia sinks into the northwest. Sirius, the dog star in the constellation Canis Major, spends this month at its highest, due south, right after dark. If you fancy a challenge and have a telescope of 10 inches or greater, then you might want to try and see its faint companion star. At 10,000 times fainter than the primary star, it's very difficult to see. However, the separation between the two is wider than it's been for nearly three decades, and so now would be a very good time to do it. 4 degrees below Sirius is the open star cluster M41, which in amongst its 100 or so stars contains several red giant stars that will appear an orange colour through binoculars. It is 2,300 light years away and is estimated to be just over 200 million years old. The constellation Perseus is high towards the west after sunset this month, and so this could be a good chance to look at one of its brightest stars, Algol, also known as the Demon Star. Algol is one of the best-known eclipsing binaries, where a smaller companion star passes in front of the large, bright primary star every 2 days, 20 hours and 50 minutes, causing it to dim. The fading and rebrightening takes about 10 hours to complete, and the best observed minima in brightness this month will happen on the 5th at 22:10, the 8th at 18:59, the 23rd at 03:06, the 25th at 23:55, and the 28th at 20:44. And finally, the asteroid Vesta will spend this month moving through the sickle of Leo and should be easily observed in binoculars or a small telescope, moving with respect to the background stars when seen over several nights, whilst Venus is slowly emerging into view very low in the sunset, visible about 30 minutes after it. It will become more and more prominent in the evening sky during the next 3 months. And that's it for the sky at night this month. Now back to Quinton and Anna.
Thanks for the sky at night there, Alex. And interestingly, Alex has won an award, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. The MyCam Video Award.
Yes, this was a competition run by Cambridge University to sort of celebrate the 800th anniversary of the university. And the idea was to make a short film about a sort of typical day in the life of someone at Cambridge University.
Yeah, and so he made a video about our lives here at the Institute of Astronomy.
Yeah, it's a really great video, and you can check it out from our outreach website.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. So have you heard about all the financial shakeups at NASA?
I have, Anna. I've been trying to keep a fairly close eye on things.
Well, the thing that's most striking to me is that the U.S. plans to privatize spaceflight.
Now, how do you, you know, as a sort of an American yourself, do you see this as the demise of NASA or more as an opportunity for other companies to get involved?
Well, NASA has always been known as an engineering company, so I think that this just means that the NASA budget can be diverted away from building rockets and trying to get people into space, and now into developing technologies for doing things once you're in space.
Well, I agree, Anna. I think this is a really sort of fantastic opportunity for other companies to get involved. I mean, we've already seen things, you know, Virgin have recently produced their prototype for getting space tourism going and their plane to get into outer space. It's a really interesting time for space science, I think.
Yeah, it is. You know, the only thing I worry about is maintaining safety standards. So, you know, even NASA with their rigorous safety standards sometimes has problems. So I just worry that when you introduce financial gain into the whole thing that you might end up cutting some safety corners.
let's hope it's all pretty rigorous, but obviously, you know, space travel is still very dangerous, and NASA go to great lengths, as do all the space organizations, to ensure that their projects go off without a hitch. Not only because, you know, the human value, but also the financial implications.
Right, and the great thing about turning this into the commercial sector is that maybe there will be a better chance for sending regular people like me and you into space someday.
Who knows? Perhaps in, you know, a few decades' time, you and I will be going up there. Perhaps not together, Anna, but, you know.
Yes, maybe someday we will make it up there.
Well, we've had a fair few laughs this month, haven't we, Anna?
Yeah, we certainly have.
Well, I think we've got time for just about one more laugh. It's that thing that you've all been waiting for. It is the astronomy joke of the month.
Hello, Quinton.
Hello, Michelle.
Are you ready to hear your last ever joke of the month?
I'm a little bit scared.
I'm not going to lie to you, Quinton. This one's going to hurt.
Ready? Okay, yep. Let me brace myself. Right, I'm ready.
Drum roll, please. What do you get if you cross an alien and a student?
Michelle, I have no idea what you get if you cross an alien with a student.
Something from another university.
Oh, oh my kidney. Oh, I think you've ruptured my kidney. Oh, God.
Well, that really was a horrific joke. I mean, my sides are still hurting.
I'm glad you survived it, though.
Yes, well, that's about all we've got for you this show, and this is my last ever goodbye, but obviously the Astropod will be back next month.
Thanks again for spending a lot of time with us, Quincy. We appreciate it, and we enjoyed having you on the show.
It's been more than a pleasure, Anna.
Great, and we hope to see you, listeners, next month.
Yes, goodbye.